You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome
to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea. I remain still the host of this program, Mark Shea.
For the time being.
I have not... Yes, there has been no meeting in France to see if I can be deposed.
Well, yeah, I'm getting together with a group.
Okay, get together with all the other co-hosts and see if you can overthrow me. That would be that could be interesting.
If all the co-hosts get together and engineer your fall. Finally,
my long reign of terror will be at an end. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we're here today, as you can tell from the other voice on the line there. That is Rod Bennett, and we are here today on this whatever fifth week, I think, maybe, or fifth Wednesday of Advent.
Lent,
right.
Yeah.
Which is a lot like Advent, except that it's Lent. And at the end of it won't
not
be
Advent,
Christmas.
Yeah. Easter. In fact, it's exactly like Advent, except that it's Lent and not Advent.
Right, exactly right. So, anyway, we are here today working through these critical
logical
issues.
Puzzles.
That's right. And I'm happy to say that I am still cancer-free. Went and had the skin exam today.
Goodness.
About a year and a half ago, my wife, I have a lot of moles. This is my lasting legacy from my mother. My mother had a lot of moles. I have a lot of moles. And
you're going in pretty often and getting them checked, huh?
Yeah, every 3 months these days. My wife bugged me a lot and said, go get your moles checked. Stop dilly-dallying and go get them checked. And so I went and had them checked. And the skin doctor said, oh, look, you have a melanoma. And here's another one. Why? And a third melanoma, too. And plus, here's another form of skin cancer on your, forehead. And so I was like, well, I guess I probably don't want to die. So, thank you, President. Well,
or some perhaps stuff that's going on these days does tend to reconcile one with the grave.
And there are others who would be delighted at that outcome, too.
Yeah.
So
that's been my experience, at any rate. So,
death for Mark Shea? That wouldn't be so bad. I mean, we'd feel blue for an afternoon, maybe. Mm-hmm. Although some people would not feel blue at all. But at any rate, I had the melanoma.
I promise, me and your friends will have a big wake for you.
Well, thanks. That means a lot. And
we could send you out into Puget Sound on a raft like a pagan chieftain and set you alight.
Yes. That would be great. You know, I wouldn't mind that, actually. That would be a great way to go.
I, Josh, we want you to continue going to the doctor, Mark, and we hope that you will live forever.
Well, thank you. I will endeavor to live longer, at any rate, at least to the end of this broadcast, because otherwise it would be a real headache for Danny, our producer, if I, just cacked it right in the middle of the show. Well, yeah, I mean, you'd have to vamp and stuff, and there'd probably be a lot of noise from, at this end from,
I have to talk you through it. That's tough.
Yeah, and there'd be, the noise.
Spiritual advice as you go, which... I'm a bad source to get that from, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, just some kind of a send-off or just prayers for me, Mm-hmm. But, I don't want to die, at least until the end of the show, so that it's just not going to be a big headache for Danny, who's going to have to, find, music to play instead of us talking, as I'm gasping out my last breaths and stuff like that. So,
it's funny, you often hear the old proverb quoted about, I want to go to heaven, but not today.
Yeah.
And it's funny that the Apostle Paul was just the opposite. He said, I want to go now. I'd much rather be there than here, but yeah, there's a bunch of work to do.
Well, especially since he was writing from a prison cell.
Well, yeah, it was getting short in that regard anyway.
Yeah.
But yes, he had the exact opposite point of view that what most of us take. And,
that's true.
You know, I think we should all be striving to get to where he was.
When the day came, he was not as I might have done with some sort of, you know, lingering cancer thing. He just got, you know, what is it Gilbert and Sullivan called a short, sharp shock.
Right. It's funny. People nowadays think beheading is the most horrible thing in the world. But really, in the days of the apostles, it was about the shortest, most reliable, less painful form of execution they had in a world without guns and, you know, all the other things, you know. So Paul rated beheading because he was a Roman citizen.
I was going to say, one of the privileges of being a Roman citizen.
That's right. Well, you compare to what his companion, Peter, what happened to him around the same time, crucified. So, Peter lingered on the tree for 3 days.
I did not know that.
Preaching to anybody that would come to listen. And that was much more normal. Our Lord's death in just a few hours was not normal. The whole point of crucifixion was that it was a long and agonizing death. It took 2 weeks sometimes.
Yeah. Wow. That was, I remember reading, Cicero said that it was just the worst way you could possibly die.
Yeah.
And, which is the idea. I mean, the idea of crucifixion was, among other things, what a lot of people don't realize today is that part of the purpose of crucifixion was to induce Stockholm syndrome in onlookers. And it worked. You wound up, a lot of times, crowds wound up jeering at the victim rather than, staging angry protests at the people who crucified him. Here's an interesting factoid for you. Up until the film was made about him, right up until about the 17th century, people who were familiar with the story of Spartacus, the leader of the great slave revolt that happened not long before the crucifixion of Jesus. Spartacus was universally regarded as the scoundrel and the villain of the piece.
In a society that
that was founded on slavery,
had a lot of slavery at that time too, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And the idea of a slave revolt was not something they wanted to encourage.
Right. And so it's very interesting. A lot of people don't realize it because what we're familiar with is the movie about Spartacus, and Spartacus is the hero. And plus, the fate that Spartacus meets is obviously hard for a Christian audience to separate from the fate that Jesus met.
Right.
So
Spartacus has gained some glory from dying the same way that our Savior did.
Right. And yet, what's interesting is that the popular response to Spartacus up until fairly recently in Christian history was not empathy or sympathy or identification of him with Jesus. It was, he and his, mob got what was coming to them. And that's what's interesting is because that's what crucifixion was designed to do. It was designed not merely to punish the victim, but to sow shame and sort of enshroud the victim in humiliation and popular disgust that people actually identified with his crucifiers rather than with the victim. And that you see that exactly happening in the Gospels at the foot of the cross. The mob is there to jeer at the victim.
one of the stumbling blocks towards receiving Christ or listening to the message for many people in the early centuries was the fact that he had been crucified.
Right.
The Jews especially, it's absolutely true that our own Old Testament that we share with the Jews has a passage in it that says, "Cursed is he who hangeth on a tree."
Right.
In other words, anybody who's killed in that particular manner has a special curse on his head, not from Roman sources, but from a Jewish source.
Right.
So, the early apologists take a surprising amount of time to deal with that problem because it apparently was pretty widespread.
Yeah, it was initially the majority of Jewish people encountering the gospel, their response was that it was prima facie obvious that Jesus couldn't be the Messiah because he was under curse.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, it's just look, he was hanging on a tree. Duh. Right. Right. You can't
they
be
could
right.
Show, it's they not could show you chapter and verse.
Right. And so, the early Christians, one of the things that they had to grapple with was exactly that stigma that attached to crucifixion, and to try to understand, because of course I'm sure it was puzzling for them. How can it be, you know, that he is the Messiah when he died in this way?
Right.
We will be right back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you are here today with Rod Bennett and me, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hey there! Hi there! Ho there! You're as welcome as can be. Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. And if you want to join the conversation, by the way, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and we can add you to the conversation as easy as that. I wanted to spend a little time talking about the readings from last Sunday because I was very struck by them. I was in particular struck by the fact that all the readings last Sunday were all about seeing and light, including the first reading, which I wanted to take a look at. It's the story of the anointing of Samuel, or the anointing by Samuel of David. So we're familiar with the story. I wanted to read over it, though, because there was just something that just stuck out to me this time that I had never really thought about before. So let me just read through the story first. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul?" Saul is the king who was king before David, who was rejected by God. "How long will you grieve over Saul, seeing I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord." So basically, Samuel goes, but he's kind of flying undercover. Because Saul is still king, and he still owns all the guns. So he can't do this out in the open. He has to kind of do it on the down low. So take the heifer, go to Jesse's house, say, "I have come to sacrifice to the Lord," and invite Jesse to the sacrifice, "and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me him whom I name to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to him, trembling, and said, "Do you come peaceably?" That's an interesting response, isn't it? And he said, "Peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked on Eliab and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, and here's the important point, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." So that's good, solid sort of Christian piety is also in that. And we've, you know, that we've heard that many times, but we go on. Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he comes here." And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. Now, here's the thing that sticks out to me. Okay, great. The Lord looks on the heart and not on outward appearance. You know, don't be such a schlemiel and just judge by how people look, right? Well, after saying that and carefully recording that, we then get the sacred author then goes into this, when David appears on the scene, what do we hear? We don't get, he was pious and had a, you know,
kind, well, he's going to show you that in the story ahead.
Right, but that's
gonna,
not
gonna
what the sacred author does.
He's going to let speak rather than appearance. But
right, but the first thing that the sacred author does,
right,
after trying this point about how don't look on the appearance, is now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And that can't be an accident. You hear that and you go, okay, this seems like, this is one of the things Scott Hahn talks about. You know, when you have these sort of moments of, you know, the holy, huh?
Right.
Where the scripture says something, you go, why did it do that? That's just like a flat contradiction of everything that you would expect. What you would have expected was he was pious and had a reputation for prayer, and he sacrificed, you know, to the Lord, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's not all, it's all about his appearance. And that's extraordinary because it is incredibly rare for Scripture to give physical descriptions of people.
Right.
You know what Jesus looked like? You know how you know what Jesus looked like? The only way you know is because iconography has settled on a picture of Jesus.
And well, it's from interesting. The earliest known picture of Jesus found in the catacombs from sometime in the second century shows him without a beard. In fact, he looks like, it looks like a picture of David. He's leading sheep and We know for other reasons that it's Jesus and not David,
right?
But one of the most iconic things that people don't recognize a picture of Jesus unless he has a beard.
Yep.
He didn't have a beard in the earliest picture,
and you will
doesn't
search
mean
the
he didn't of... have one in real life, but he didn't have one in that picture.
Right. You will search the length and breadth of the New Testament for a physical description of Jesus, and you won't find one. The most important human being who ever lived, according to the New Testament, and we have no clue from the sacred authors what he looks like, because it's very rare. And that's what really struck me about this reading, was that the sacred author, having gone out of his way to say that the appearance doesn't matter, then goes into one of the only physical descriptions ever offered of somebody in the entire Bible. Right?
It's pretty interesting, isn't it?
And so my question then is, why does he do that? And I think the reason that he does that, this is just my own theory, of course, but I think there is a reason that he does that. I don't think it's just an accident. And I think that his point is that nobody saw David. It didn't even occur to his own father to invite him to this thing.
Yeah, he wasn't even there.
Yeah,
he's underage.
He's invisible.
Yeah.
And that's the point, is that when you actually look at David, you go, hey, this guy, you know, he's handsome, he's, you know, but nobody saw him. And why didn't they see him? Well, I think there are two reasons that they don't see him. First of all, is because of his age. They just don't see him because he's too young to matter. And it's also, of course, because of his social position. He's not just young. He's young and doing the equivalent of, you know, garbage collection, or, you know,
he's last in line in a society that held the firstborn in special esteem.
Right. And he's a shepherd, and shepherds don't matter.
Right.
And so he's not seen. And that's what's striking is that the appearance, which is the only thing that the eye can see, the appearance doesn't make an appearance for anybody at that gathering, because other things render him invisible. He was perfectly good looking, but they didn't see it. And they didn't see it because of his age and because of his social standing. And that kind of thing can make people invisible.
I think I remember a piece of ancient Christian commentary, although I can't give you the name of who said it, who meditated on this passage a little bit. And he put the emphasis on the idea that people had a different paradigm in mind for what a king should look like.
Mm.
That sometimes we're blinded by paradigm shifts, the need to make a paradigm shift.
Right.
You know, I had an experience just the other day looking for a bottle of ibuprofen, suffering from allergies as we do in spring around here. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find it. Was looking in our medicine cabinet and amongst our medicine, and just absolutely was convinced we were out. And my wife told me, well, there it is right there. And it was in a big, big bottle of a different color. The smaller bottle that I was looking for had run out. And it was right there in my face. If it had been a snake, it would have bit me.
Uh-huh.
And I had to do a paradigm shift. Of course, once you start looking for the word ibuprofen, you see it right away, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And it may have been something like that here. In other words, the idea, they had preconceived ideas of what a king of Israel would look like.
Yeah.
And David didn't fit the preconceived idea.
Right. Well, and that takes
so I think this piece of commentary I'm remembering emphasizes the idea that he didn't look like what they thought they wanted.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we will continue that discussion when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Rod Bennett, and we're talking about last Sunday's readings, and we'll talk about the man born blind when we return on Redbox Media. See you in a minute.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We'll be right back. with the inimitable, the inexorable,
impenetrable,
the impenetrable, the inescapable, Rod Bennett. Yep. Inexorable never has a nice sound to it, you know.
That implies somebody who has been continuously getting more and more of his way, and that definitely doesn't apply to my.
Okay. So, anyway, we were talking last time about the fact that the reason David, despite the fact that he's, you know, he's ruddy and has beautiful eyes and his handsome and all the rest of it, he just was not seen. He was invisible to his father, to everybody at that gathering, until Saul asked to see him. And I think that that's why the sacred author focuses on David's looks, is because he was invisible. And he's getting that point across. And it, and then what's interesting is the church puts that reading together with the story last Sunday of the man born blind. And once again, we have a story that's all about sight. And it's also about invisibility. And
the, well,
and
like, the church, like many of the ways in which the church puts the readings together.
Right.
One of the passages, it's not obvious that it's related to the other two unless until you read the other two.
Right.
And this is a case. You wouldn't know that the story of David's being chosen was a story about blindness until you notice that the other two readings are about blindness.
Yes. And it's also, and the of course, the story of the man born blind is also about a Davidic king, the son of David, who is not recognized. And the paradox is that the people who are blind to him are the ones who can see, and the one who can see who he is was blind.
Right.
And so you watch that dialogue go on, and there's all kinds of, you know, part of what you get, of course, are all kinds of theories about, you know, why is this guy blind? And so everybody is sure that it must be somebody's fault that he's blind. The theory going in that his own apostles are asking Jesus about is, you know, why was this guy, who sinned? They don't even question whether somebody sinned. The only thing they want to know is who's the guilty party. Was it this guy or his parents that he was born blind? It's got to be somebody's fault.
Well, they turned it into an abstract theological discussion on a niggling point, you know.
Right.
What's the cause of these kind of evils, birth defects and other things like that. And there's a much more immediate issue at hand.
Right. And Jesus' reply is nobody sinned. This is not because somebody sinned. This is happening so that the glory of God can be revealed.
Interesting. People who still to this day look at the story sometimes use it to say, well, see, people don't inherit the sins of their parents, or it wasn't his fault prior to birth or anything. The story doesn't even say that. Jesus just says, in this particular case, he doesn't rule on whether these things ever happen. He just says, I know why this particular man was born the way he was, which is a claim of divinity, obviously.
Right.
And I'll tell you the reason why. It was so that I can do this miracle in front of you guys.
Right. Yeah.
and so that the glory of the Lord would be revealed.
Yep. So
but he doesn't rule out the idea that sins might be passed down in the way that they're describing. But that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion. Whenever it tends to come up, he tends to point in other directions. So the people that got... Although what's interesting is the people who got, you know, killed by the falling tower, for example.
He says, do you think that these people were more sinful than any of the other people in the city?
Exactly. Yeah. He doesn't say these people were innocent. He says, do you think these people were any more guilty than everybody else? You know?
Right, yeah.
And so
like we said, that's another discussion.
Yeah. So that's intriguing. So he
It's a dodge on the part of the Pharisees.
I,
they're just looking for a way here to discredit Christ and his miracles. In other words, the miracles are making them look bad.
Right, yeah. And so when the guy is healed, so he takes some spit. I always wonder, you know, what that must have been like for the blind guy, right? But there's like a couple of moments where Jesus uses his own spit as a means of healing. And I'm sure that there's...
Apologetics-wise, the story is gold.
Yeah.
Because evangelicals tend to say, well, what's all this rigmarole, all this hocus-pocus with using oil and using all of these sacramental, all this physicality, candles and you know, all of this kind of stuff. Just pray to the Lord and make your request known, and he cares for you and all of this. And you can direct them to this story where the Lord himself, the second person of the Trinity, uses a sacramental to heal somebody.
Yeah, makes clay out of spittle. And by the way, of course, making clay out of the ground has a certain resonance in the Israelite tradition.
Right.
Because that's how Adam was made.
Right.
And so he anoints the guy's eyes with this clay and then tells him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. And so he goes and does that. And by the way, Siloam means sent. The Greek word for sent or sending is apostolos. And so part of what's being spoken here is that this guy is going to become a witness, an apostle. He's going to be a sent one of Christ. And so that's what he does. He sends him to this pool called Sent. The guy washes and he comes away able to see. And then this conflict starts. So they bring the guy to the Pharisees. Why would the crowd that was present there bring him to the Pharisees? Because they're priests, and when you're healed, you're supposed to present yourself to the priests to say, I was healed. The problem was, he got healed on a Sabbath. And this is one of the things that just stuck in the Pharisaic crawl, was Jesus kept healing on the Sabbath. He does this repeatedly.
And they classified healing as a work.
As a work.
And the law of Moses forbid any work on Sabbath.
Right. So the Pharisees
on the Jewish Sabbath.
Right. So the Pharisees have this system. They've got things figured out. Healing on the Sabbath, you can't do that. That proves that you can't be a holy man.
You're a lawbreaker. And
you're a lawbreaker.
You can't be from God.
Right.
You're a sinner.
And so they ask the guy, and this is just classic. You know, one of the things that I've said in the past is, you know, Robert Benchley said that there are two kinds of people in the world, those who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. And
D.K. Chesterton was definitely one of those that divided the world into two kinds of people.
Two kinds of people. And so these guys also belonged to one of two classes of people. I say there are two kinds of people in the world, those who ask questions to find things out and those who ask questions to keep from finding things out.
Is this a real question or is this a rhetorical question?
Yeah.
It's
and
something
these guys,
when I encounter evangelicals who are hostile, I have gotten breakthroughs in the past by responding to questions by saying, are you really asking this question or is this a rhetorical question? Are you trying to trap me the way the Pharisees tried to trap the Savior?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what's going on here. So they start by, you know, what did he do to you? And the guy says, well, he put clay on my eyes and I washed and now I can see. I mean, that's what happened, right?
And, pretty straightforward, and just the facts.
And if they really wanted to know, they would go, okay.
And but that's all there is to know about it.
That's all there is to ask him, right? What happened?
And they find three more ways to ask the same question.
Yes, they do. And what's interesting is every time they ask the question, they don't learn anything. Because they're bound and determined not to learn anything. They don't want, they've already figured this out. This man is not from God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath. But the blind guy and the other people are standing around and going, well, wait a minute. I mean, how can a sinner do these things? So they go to the blind guy again. And now they're not asking him what happened. Now they're asking him, to where they stand on this guy. Are you with him? Or are you with us? So they say, well, what do you say about him? And this is where things get interesting, because now all of a sudden he's not talking about what happened to him. They're asking him to what he thinks about it. And he says, well, he's a prophet. Well, uh-oh. Yeah. So you sound like you're on his side. And so then they start coming up with, well, you were never blind.
And we've got to find another explanation here, because that answer obviously is not acceptable.
Right, yeah. So we will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here with Rod Bennett. We're talking about the Sunday readings and the man born blind. And we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. And we're talking about the story of the man born blind. So they bring the blind guy to the Pharisees. They ask him what happened. He tells them what happened. And then arguments start because this is a crowd of Jewish people, and that's what crowds of Jewish people do, is argue with each other. And so they say, well, what do you say about him? And the blind guy says, well, he's a prophet. And so then the argument is, well,
the apostles, by the way, have already told us this in advance. In other words, when they were asked, who do men say that I am? They say, well, you're one of the prophets, which is the same answer that the blind man gives here.
Which is a reasonable
answer in so far as it goes.
Right. Well, and if you were blind and now you can see, that's not a hard conclusion to come to.
And you're behaving the way that Elijah did. Elijah healed the blind man.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a very good answer.
They're not happy with the answer because they really don't want to accept that Jesus is a prophet. So they go and get the guy's parents. And the parents basically go, he's of age. Ask him. We don't want to get into the middle of this because
that was a shrewd answer.
and they're afraid of getting thrown out of synagogue, which has already started to happen.
Right.
So they go back to the blind guy and then they tell him, you know, they basically issue a threat. They say, give God the praise. That's a kind of a legal oath. It's a way of putting him under oath. And then they tell him the verdict of the court, if you will, before he's been asked the question. We know that this man is a sinner. Now tell us what you think about him. And the blind guy says, well, I don't know if he's a sinner or not. One thing I do know is I was blind and now I can see, which is, again, you know, hard to argue with. So then they ask him again, what did he do to you? You know, how did he open your eyes? And he's like, you already asked me this. Why do you want me to tell you again? And then he says, do you want to be his disciples too? Uh-oh.
Well, he's getting sassy with him.
And it's like,
mouth in the courtroom.
You're one of his disciples, you know? And then they say this magnificent piece of illogic. They say, you're his disciple, but we're disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but we don't even know where this guy comes from. To which the blind man very sensibly replies, if you don't know where he comes from, how do you know he's a sinner? Nobody's ever opened the eyes of a blind guy before, and he just did it. So why do you consider the possibility that he's not a sinner? At which point...
The dogma that they're... And this is a big can of worms that Mark and I talked about briefly during the break. But the dogma that they're unwilling to question is their dogma about the kind of... about the perpetual nature of the law of Moses.
Right.
That they're convinced that because the law of Moses forbade this kind of activity on the Sabbath, that automatically makes Jesus a sinner. You did this work on a Sabbath day, and you're automatically a sinner for that reason. So they have a dogma, and what he has done contradicts the dogma.
Right.
They're unwilling
they
to question the dogma.
Out.
It's a very questionable idea about whether Moses' law was intended to be permanent.
Right.
And this is the reason why they're claiming to be... continue to follow Moses. We'll stick. They're basically saying we'll stay loyal to Moses. Okay,
right.
Is this guy greater than Moses? And of course, they asked Jesus himself pretty much that in several places, and he gives them an answer that they don't like, which is why they're mad.
Before Abraham was, I am. And and so that's what it comes out to. So at that point, they explain to the blind man, shut up. And they kick him out. And as he gets kicked out, then Jesus comes to him and asks him, do you believe in the Son of Man? And then there's this kind of electrifying exchange where the blind man says, well, who is he that I may believe in? Because remember, the blind man couldn't see Jesus when Jesus healed him. And when he came back from having his eyes washed, Jesus was gone by that point, so he didn't know what Jesus looked like. And so when Jesus comes to him and says, do you believe in the Son of Man? His question is very logical. He says, well, who is he that I may believe in him? And this is the amazing response that Jesus gives. You have seen him. And so the man goes from saying that Jesus is a prophet to saying, Lord, I believe. So initially he was just a man named Jesus healed me. Then he's a prophet. And then finally he's ultimately able to see who Jesus is in the profoundest sense of seeing. At which point the Pharisees, come along and say, Jesus says, for judgment I came into the world that those who do not see may see and those who see may become blind. And so the Pharisees are tremendously offended by this. Are you telling us we're blind? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and then we come to the kind of chilling capstone of the whole story about blindness.
If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. And
there
this is, wow, And so that's what the readings are all about. And, of course, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, where are we blind? And the problem with being blind is you can't see where you're blind.
Right. It's a principle of Catholic moral theology that the more light you've been given, the greater your responsibility and the greater your sinfulness.
Yeah.
If you sin against the light.
Yeah.
In other words, it'll go easier on the judgment day over some poor polygamist in the South American jungle who never heard of monogamy.
Right.
For his five wives, it'll go easier on him in the judgment day than it will for the Christian who recited the Ten Commandments and all the rest of it and committed adultery anyway.
Right.
Because the Christian had vastly more light. And you're in the position of the Pharisees at that point. Because you've said you see, then your sin remains.
Right.
So
yeah.
That's an incredibly important principle in the Christian life is the danger of sinning against the light is the most important consideration in many ways for the Christian. There's another old poem, I don't know who wrote it, but that light embraced bringeth light. But light rejected bringeth night. That's in other words, you accept and embrace the light that you're given. That's the way to greater light, to greater knowledge, to greater happiness and holiness. But to reject the light is the way to head into a final state in which there's no light at all.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's that conflict between those who really can see and those who say they can see is what this gospel is about. You know, the blind man really does see something. He not only, you know, regains his physical sight, but then he is granted the grace to see who it is that Jesus actually is. And so he makes, you know, we were talking earlier about paradigm shifts. He makes this paradigm shift. He realizes who Jesus actually is, calls him Lord, in fact. And yet the Pharisees can't see it because they won't see it.
Yeah. What was the proper response for the Pharisees? The response that God wanted from the Pharisees was to say, okay, never yet has a man born blind been healed like this. This is the first. Some people are under the impression that the Bible is just chock-a-block with miracles, but one of the more interesting things about it is that when Jesus comes doing all these miracles, it's been hundreds of years. I mean, the Old Testament is peppered here and there with miracles, but a lot of people have the impression that it's one long miracle book. But really, it had been hundreds of years since people had seen these kinds of acts of healing in Israel, since the time of Elijah, really, Elijah and Elisha. Yeah. And so the man born blind has the correct response to what he's experienced. He has a childlike response. He's a prophet.
Right.
The Pharisees let a dogma get in the way. They've got a piece of theology that they are not willing to question for various reasons we could go into. Mm-hmm. And it's getting in their way. So what was God really trying to get them to do? He was trying to get them to do what's so hard for us sinners to do, and that is to go, well, gee.
Consider the possibility they're wrong. Exactly. That's if they had only done that.
Right. And it's so much with us today is how hard is it to just say, you know, okay, so the Pope makes a declaration on a matter of moral practice that goes against something that I have always thought was right. Did he screw up or did I? Or is the easier answer, gee, I must have missed a step somewhere.
I must have missed a step somewhere. Exactly right. Rod Bennett, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. We will be back tomorrow. With Deacon Stephen Gurdonis. Our producer today was Danny Head. And I am, as ever, your host, Mark Shea. And I will see you all tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.